Just like rereading the Nate Jing will give you some new perspectives, listening again to a conversation with Sabina Wilms about the Nate Jing will give you a renewed appreciation for this canonical text of ours. I particularly enjoy her perspective because she has Zhuangzi and Sun Si Miao in her back pocket, and so our medical texts end up flavored with a bit of poetry and love when Sabina is talking about them. These conversations come to you through the generous support of our sponsors and members. All the sponsors here provide helpful products or services that you'll find beneficial in your clinical work. Worried that an EMR is too complex for you? Jane has friendly and knowledgeable support. Mayway Herbs is celebrating the 55th year of their family business. You're invited to make use of their vast library of resources. Are you concerned about the health of Mother Earth? AccuFast Needles is doing something about that. You can too. And later in the show, Ancestral Sturman offers up a sinew treatment, and the folks at Blue Poppy have something special to share as well. Do be sure to visit the sponsors page on the Geological website to take advantage of all the special offers our terrific sponsors have for listeners of the podcast.
Hi folks, I'm Yvonne Lau, president of Mayway Herbs. Our family business turns 55 this year, and we wouldn't have gotten this far without the love and support of our community. We're truly grateful and promise you that we'll continue to work hard to support you and your practice. Please visit Mayway.com to find the perfect Pumsar brand formula or formulate your own in our dispensary. Our site also has lots of articles, videos, and herbal recipes for you to explore. And tune into our podcast, Chinese Medicine Matters, for insightful discussions on all things TCM. Learn about treatment strategies and powerful herbal remedies. As we welcome the month of May, our focus is on women's health. Our newsletter articles and podcast episodes this month will highlight different aspects and unique challenges women face. So subscribe or tune in. And if you're a practitioner, get a discount on our women's health formulas this month. Just visit Mayway.com. This season and every season, trust Mayway Herbs for your health and wellness needs. And thank you for supporting Real Chinese Medicine.
I love how technology can help to automate my office, and I want to share with you my favorite tool for doing so, Jane. Jane is a clinic management software in EMR with a human touch. Whether you're switching your software or going paperless for the first time, the Jane team knows that the onboarding process can feel a little overwhelming. That's why with Jane, you don't just get software, you get a whole team. Included in every Jane subscription is their award-winning customer support available by phone, email, and chat whenever you need it, even Saturdays. You can also book a free account setup consultation to review your account and ensure you feel confident about going live. If you're interested in making the switch to Jane, head to jane.app/switch to book a one-on-one demo with a member of their support team. And be sure to mention the code CHEOLOGICAL at the time of sign up for a 1 month grace period on your new Jane account. I don't know about you, but sometimes I take a step back and marvel at my acupuncture needles. I mean, they're the world's simplest medical tool, a sharpened wire and a handle. That's it. And with this simple tool, hundreds of health conditions can be resolved. I love it. What I didn't love was the amount of packaging waste I generated at the end of the day. But that has now changed too. Ever since I switched to AccuFast Earth-Friendly Needles, I reduced my packaging waste by 90%. Not only are they a great needle, but the folks at AccuFast plant a tree for every two boxes of needles I use in the clinic. By switching to AccuFast Needles, you'll be helping patients, planting trees, and joining a community of practitioners changing the world. Like our simple needle, being a part of the solution, it's simple too. Visit AccuFastNeedles.com/geological to learn how. I hope you have enjoyed these encore conversations here in the late summer season. I will be back next week with some new conversations here on Geological. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Geological. I am very excited to be sitting down for a cup of tea, well, across several time zones, but still sitting down for a cup of tea with Sabina Wilms. Sabina Wilms is an author. She's a translator. She's done amazing books for art profession. One of which, her newest, Humming with Elephants. Oh my God. I'm not here to plug stuff. You guys got to go buy this book. I'm very excited that we're going to sit down. We're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about some other stuff. We're going to talk about what's in the book. That's even better. And Chinese medicine in general, and maybe some Chinese language. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure where the conversation goes, because when you start exploring a thing about resonance, who knows where you go. Sabine, welcome to Geological.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a total pleasure and honor.
I'm so excited about this. So I'm curious. I want to go back in time a little bit. How is it? Because, again, this book of yours is gorgeous. I want to know how it is that you so fell in love with the Chinese language and Chinese medicine.
Way back. You want to go way back.
As far back as we need to go.
I was in high school, and my family, everybody in my family is doctors, biomedical doctors. Both of my parents, my sister went into medical school. My uncles and aunts, my grandmother was one of the first practicing pediatricians in Germany, female, her husband, everybody. And when I was 18, I wanted to get as far away from that as possible. So I have a dad who knows everything because he's a very famous doctor. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do Chinese because he doesn't know anything about China. And I love traveling, and for whatever bizarre reason, I love dead languages. I actually started out studying Latin and Greek, and then there's been so much research done in Latin and Greek, and everything is translated. So classical Chinese is just a wonderful field, and I absolutely love translating, reading, understanding, engaging with the classical texts. So I guess I'm a nerd.
Total nerd. Are you kidding?
I'm such a nerd, and it's okay. It makes me really, really happy to spend 12 hours sitting there and reading the Neijing. So, and then I got into East Asian studies, and then I had this wonderful professor in medical anthropology who was just fascinated with the fact that I can speak Chinese and I have access to these medical texts. And he really opened my eyes to how medicine can be such a powerful window into the culture. So that's how I got into studying medicine, really as a way of trying to understand Chinese culture. And then, so I got my PhD, and then I started teaching at a Chinese medicine school in Tucson. And I love teaching practitioners because you guys, or writing books for practitioners, because compared to a normal, you know, university, when you're a history professor or literature professor or something, you guys actually really care about my work. And you take what I produce, whether it's gynecology or pediatrics, or even, you know, this new book, Humming with Elephants, and you make a difference in your patient. I believe, and that's the feedback I get, that my work makes a difference in alleviating suffering of all your patients. So I'm so lucky that I'm in this field. It's like, how could I be anywhere else?
I'm delighted that you're in our field, because your works, yeah, it's the old stuff. And digging things out of Wen Yanwen, I mean, I can speak and I understand some modern Chinese. It's rough. But you get into that classical stuff, I mean, they don't even have punctuation, for goodness sakes.
Well, they have particles. That's where grammar comes in. Can I make a plug for classical Chinese grammar?
Yeah, let's hear it.
It's just that in my mind, classical Chinese is, you can't just do the etymology and ignore the grammar, which is how I started learning classical Chinese. But, you know, the shoots, the empty words that when you learn classical, or when I learned classical Chinese when I lived in Taiwan, that's where I started studying classical Chinese, they would just talk about the empty particles. Oh, these are just the empty particles that you kind of wave off. And that's just not true. These are the equivalent of punctuation marks. And they give you, I mean, there is a stretch. There's something where a sentence can have so many different layers of meaning, but at the same time, it's also very clear. And the more you know about classical Chinese, the more you can be very clear whether something is a proper or potential interpretation or it's not. And these particles are really important in understanding that.
So they're not empty. They actually are sort of like signposts. They help you to orient to the text. Now, well, you know, maybe we'll come back at some point and do a super nerdy, like, introduction to reading Wen Yan Wen or something. That would actually, oh, man. You know, I don't know how many of our listeners would be into that, but I bet there'd be a few geeky ones. We'll come back to that.
And then I guess the other thing that got me interested in fertility or yangsheng was that I ended up being a farmer. I had a biodynamic farm in New Mexico. And farming is all of you're doing it the way I like to do it. It's all about fertility. I was raising goats and apples and herbs. And it's you're working with soil and it's fertility. And then I was a kind of a bad farmer, right? And then I was going to all these conferences teaching about yangsheng and fertility and reproductive medicine. And at some point I just put the two together that nurturing life and fertility in the medical sense and in the agricultural sense, it's the same thing. And that's really where I now feel like I have this life where it all fits together, where everything, I have had all these bizarre experiences in my life. And that's, you know, part of like music. I'm talking about resonance, humming. It's all about music. I'm a violinist. It's like everything, all the experiences in my life have kind of come together in making sense at this point. It's been a long time. Other people figure out what they do when they're 20 years old. But
I'm not sure how many actually do. I know some folks that at a very young, tender age, they knew it. I got a younger brother, age like 11 or something. I'm going to be a musician. That's it. He's a musician.
Yeah.
You know, but most people that I know, and maybe it's just a crowd I run around in, we're not so sure. And there's a phase here, there's a phase there. You go in this direction, you go in that direction. And if you're lucky to live long enough, maybe it comes together with a certain coherence where you can look back 30 years and go, I can see how that stream from back then is alive right now. But it takes living into it.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
So resonance, actually, all right. So of all the chapters of the Huangdi Neijing, why this one?
Oh dear. Well, I taught a class with the wonderful, most esteemed Dr. Long Yuhui at NUNM, the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. It was the third year in a 3-year series on classical texts. So it was kind of the crowning achievement of their education in classical texts, which is the cornerstone of their doctoral program. And the third year is all about the Neijing. So Dr. Long and I, and we had a classical text committee, we got together and we created a curriculum for the chapters that we all considered the most important in the Neijing for beginning practitioners. And it was, and then the classes kind of evolved, and Sue and Five ended up being a class that just ended up taking an entire semester, an entire course of 12 weeks to cover. And originally I was going to do, I think, a textbook for classical Chinese, and it was going to have Su Wen 1 through 5 and then a bunch of clinical chapters in it. And then I was like, okay, this is way too much. It's going to get way too long. So we're just going to do Su Wen 1 through 5. And then I ended up just doing Su Wen 5 because I just kept going back to it and quoting it in all my teachings. I just refer to it over and over. And, you know, really the resonance of yin and yang. I mean, that's the foundation of the medicine, that it kind of makes sense. But it was supposed to be a much bigger project.
Well, it still might be. You never know.
Is plenty big enough.
Well, yeah, but there's other books to do.
It's just such a rich chapter, and it has a history of wonderful commentaries.
So what do you particularly love about this chapter?
I think it's the ideal, it's the perfect introduction to the foundations of our medicine. It just, you know, it's about yin and yang, and it's about the correlation between the macro, the resonance, and it's more than a correlation. It's really about the interrelationship between the macrocosm and the microcosm. And it just lays it out. It starts with a very simple thing where it talks about the weather, about the clouds and the rain, and then it brings it to the level of the flavors. And then it goes into the body. I mean, it just covers everything in a very succinct way. And it's just, to me, this chapter is so deep. And that's I've been working on this book for like 5 years, and I've canned it so many times and said, I'm not touching that. And, you know, I don't think anybody can ever create a perfect translation of Suwen 5, because it's kind of like the Lao Tzu. It's so deep and complex that I'm going to give you one perspective on it and one possible way of reading it, and you can create another way that's just as beautiful and profound and accurate as mine. There is no right and wrong, or maybe there are ways that you can read it that are grammatically wrong.
So there are ways of doing it wrong, and there's also many ways of doing it right.
Yeah. I don't think one English version can ever, and that's why I ended up with all these commentaries and all these discussions and all these, like in my book, I have all these notes where I'm choosing to translate it as this, right? But it could also be read as this. And that's based on, you know, 1500 years of commentary tradition. And I believe that I'm not smart enough with a blank slate to go and read the Neijing. It's a text that's very corrupted, that's from a really ancient time, that's really, really difficult. There are passages in there that I really don't get. So I'm not an enlightened sage. So I think it's crazy for us, or maybe not crazy, but I think it's arrogant to throw out 1500 years of commentary tradition. And I really wanted to give readers a sense of the depth and the contributions that generation after generation after generation of scholar physicians, of these incredibly educated, wise, experienced people have added to an understanding of the Neijing, because I think a lot of times that gets lost in the English translations.
Well, one of the really delightful things I remember when I was first in acupuncture school and reading through, I mean, we had Unschuld at that point. I remember the Nanjing in particular. You'd have each of the difficulties, and then you'd have pages of commentary, pages of commentary. And there were people that were talking to each other across the centuries. In fact, they were not just talking to each other. Sometimes they were arguing with each other, vehemently arguing and disagreeing across the centuries. And I loved it.
And I think that the Nanjing is actually, Unschuld's Nanjing translation is a wonderful contribution. And of all of his books, that's my favorite book, I think. And it is, you know, the language is not that easy to read. It's not pre-digested to make it appealing to modern clinical practitioners.
Oh, not at all. No, if you're looking for the answer, you're not going to find it in there. I'll tell you that.
It's a hard book to read.
It requires attentiveness.
It requires a really great interest and nerdy bend. And part of what I'm hoping with my book is that it's a little bit that I'm writing for practitioners. That's with this book. My other books, it was like, you know, my pediatrics, I know it's for really advanced practitioners, and I don't sell a lot of those books, and I know I don't try and push it on people. I'm very clear that my pediatrics book is not appropriate for a beginning practitioner, because it's not pre-digested. Nobody's holding your hand. It's just Sun Simiao is throwing these formulas at you. And they're very powerful formulas, and they would be really dangerous to apply if you don't have the proper training. But what I'm hoping with this book is I really want to show a broader audience of Chinese medicine practitioners that the classics are relevant to contemporary Chinese medicine, because I believe they are. And that's what I get in my, you know, many, many years of teaching at these conferences, or when I do these one day or weekend seminars, a work like Unschuld's is so academic and it's scholarly, and it's just, if you don't have the proper academic training, it could turn you off just because it's so thick. And like you said, there's commentary and then there's the next commentary. And so I was really struggling. And that's kind of how I started out with this book. And then I just completely scrapped it all and started from scratch and rewrote that book like 5 times. In the way that I hope that it makes it, I want to show a normal Chinese medicine practitioner that the classics are relevant.
Well, I think you have a very interesting way of showing that it's relevant. You use the term pre-digested. And I would say your book is completely non-pre-digested. It's more like a prebiotic. Right.
I know I'm in this crazy bubble.
No. I mean, it's a phenomenal bubble. Your instructions in the beginning about read it slowly.
Yeah.
Along with naps and walks and cups of tea and, you know, walking by the water. So, I mean, I think of it as like sipping whiskey and talking to friends. I think of it as something that I come back to really like a book of poetry. There are ways that you have in there of giving us something, but you don't nail anything down. It's not like, oh, here's the thing and here's what it is, and you read this and get it, and now you're going to understand it. It's more like you weave these questions, you bring in these various influences, you hint and tease at different kinds of things, you bring in some comments from people across the ages. I find that I get done reading a section, you know, and it's only a couple of pages, and it's like, that's enough for today.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
And sometimes I go back the next day and reread it again, or sometimes I'll pick it up a week later and read certain portions of it again, because it leaves me with a sense of inquiry. It leaves me with a sense of, I mean, I feel like my perceptual field is a little bit different. My thinking process is a little bit altered after reading it.
Good. I mean, I don't like giving lectures, even though that's what I, you know, do a lot of the time for a living. My favorite classes are, in a way, the book is a way to replicate this wonderful seminar that was the treat for me to get to teach these Neijing classes at NUNM, because I put the students through such a hard time in the first year of study, memorizing the characters and learning the grammar and you know, and we read Confucius, we read the Great Learning, we read Lao Tzu and Zhuang Zi and poetry, and I throw all this stuff at them and I make them struggle very hard with classical Chinese. And then in the second year, they get the Shanghanlun and Jingwei, which is more clinical, and it's much easier and more straightforward. It is, right?
Yes.
I mean, they're formulas, they're symptoms, and then it's that one, the grammar is fairly straightforward. But in the third year, you get to the Neijing, and it is such a fun book to explore in a class over the course of 12 weeks. And the idea, you know, that we had a different student prepare a section each week, and then we would get together and discuss it together. Mm. And it was just such a fun class. I love doing it. So in a way, the book is about replicating that format of doing an advanced seminar where everybody comes, where you bring your experience and your knowledge and your work to it. And then I engage with you. And I don't think it can be a one-way street where I know everything, because we're talking about literature that was created, I believe, by by enlightened beings. I mean, by the sages, right? This is what the Yellow Emperor was a sage, and he's talking about these teachings from the sages that were thousands of years before that. So who am I to tell you? Well, it's over my head. It's over your head. I firmly believe that we don't have the understanding of, we don't live integrated into the macrocosm the way these people did, because we are separated through central heating and air conditioning and electricity. We don't grow our own food. We don't have the connection to, we don't have the knowledge of the stars, the cycles of the stars. I'm trying to understand tides here because I live on a beach and I can only do this walk that I love to do when the tides are certain, when they're low and they have to be incoming or outcoming. So I'm trying to wrap my head around stars and moon and tides, and it's just mind-boggling. And I think there's just so much that we don't know that they knew. They had a different kind of wisdom, insights.
Hello everyone, Anne Cecil Sturman here. A working knowledge of the 8 extraordinary channels from the unbroken oral tradition of acupuncture is valuable beyond words. The power of these channels is tremendous if the practitioner has well integrated diagnostic, theoretical, and practical skill. You'll be familiar with Dumai, the governor channel or the Sea of Yang, the primal reservoir of Yang, which ultimately finances all movement and growth. But this channel also governs the ability to self-determine. The psycho-emotional presentation of your patients can be matched to a classical activation of this channel, clearing impedance in the free flow of Yang Qi to body, mind, and spirit. I'd like to share with you the marvelous potency of the Du channel in a full-length live treatment video from the seminar I taught last year in Melbourne, Australia. It's at annececilsturman.com/sinews2024. Click on the Jump to Free Teaching button or see the link on my Instagram page at annececilsturman. Thanks, Michael. Back to you.
And I think that books like this, they're not how-to manuals.
Yeah.
I mean, they really are looking, I suspect, to crack our perception open in a certain way. Because then you can start to learn some things. But it requires a different stance, so to speak. Does that make sense?
I love the crack open our perception. It's about cracking open the idea that we know what's white and black and right and wrong and this and that and yes and no. I love Zhuangzi. I mean, Zhuangzi is my hero. And I think that's that piece, which is really challenging for a medical practitioner, right? To
yes.
be in the space of not knowing.
Because, yes, exactly. This is a very curious paradox. I was going to say, especially for Chinese medicine practitioners, but that may not be true. It may be for any medicine practitioner. We do want to know. There's a lot that we should know. We should be very schooled in what the stuff that you're supposed to be schooled in.
Right.
And people expect to get some help from us. And, you know, we better show up with some goods. That's only fair. And at the same time, so often patients come in and the truth is we don't know. And that's not a stopping place. That's the starting place. And how do you navigate when you don't know? That to me is a very profound and powerful question that I suspect all practitioners have to face in being any kind of a doctor.
And it's one that I have thought about very hard, because my dad was the first person in Germany who treated AIDS, he went to Seattle to learn about bone marrow transplants. All the stuff that I know nothing about. He was a director of an internal medicine hospital. And he did all these cutting edge things. And a lot of his patients must have died. And right? Because he was doing things that they didn't know what they were at the time. And I had a boyfriend, and I was talking to my boyfriend's dad, who was also a doctor. And I was telling him that my dad drives me crazy because he knows everything. And he has this, and it is so hard. I am totally like my dad. My dad and I are like, I am so close to him. And we drive each other nuts. But he is so opinionated and he knows everything. And it was another old retired doctor who had to point out to me that's that generation of biomedical doctors. They had to know everything. Because if my dad started questioning his treatments, biomedical doctors have a really high rate of substance abuse and suicide and all of this stuff. So I think in Chinese medicine, I'm hoping we are much more honest about that we don't know. Because in Chinese medicine, there are so many ways in which you can address. There is no one right way. And that's so hard for students. And I think it's really dangerous. It's one of those things. And I'm not an anti-biomedicine person at all. I think all medicine, all doctors are healers and do the best they can. But in biomedicine, there is this huge pressure that the doctor is the authority and the doctor has to know. And because of that, I think it closes inquiry. And it's really hard on people's heart and mind. Because if you're a doctor, you must know that you don't know. But you can't doubt yourself if you're a very famous biomedical doctor. And in a way, and I'm not a practitioner, I don't see patients. Or I say I'm a practitioner of Chinese medicine, but I'm not a clinical practitioner. I do practice Chinese medicine every day, all day long, just on myself and just in a different way. But in a way, if you're a doctor and a patient comes to you, you have to be the authority.
Yes. And sometimes that authority sits or stands with you at the edge of, well, we don't know. And then how do we find out? Where do you move? What's the next step after I don't know?
Yeah. And how do you make peace with that?
I think that's a great question. How do you make peace with that?
Yeah. And that's where, to me, the classical text, that's the big contribution in the classics and also in the philosophy, that the true knowledge is in not knowledge. The Tao that can be Taoed, the way that can be walked, is not the constant Tao, right? The Tao that can be taught, anytime you see, that's not the real Tao.
Yeah, from the very beginning, we're in deep water with this stuff.
I don't know. And I see it as my job to just kind of open the curtains, be like, well, and part of it is that I've spent the last 5 years teaching beginning Chinese medicine students and kind of really opening their eyes. Day one, they had me for the beginning Chinese history and culture class for beginning classical text. We did a Chinese culture immersion retreat. They got a whole lot of Sabina. And part of that is embracing this other way of thinking and honoring this, you know, and you have to have knowledge and you have to have systematized textbooks and you have to have licenses and board exams. And you have to have exams if you have an institutionalized medicine. So weird. Chinese medicine is in this weird place where, at least at NCNM or NUNM, it was always this tension between, on the one side, we teach, you know, what they need to know and what can be tested, and the board exams, we teach them knowledge that's graspable, and you need to be able to communicate to patients and to colleagues. You have to know. And at the same time, when you are more advanced, at some point, when you know enough, you have to know that you don't know.
At a certain point, all of the knowing that we've acquired, and it's very helpful because we do get to pass the exam, we get to get a license, we get to get started. I often think of that stuff as scaffolding. It's the stuff that lets us get started. It's the stuff, especially as Westerners, that allows us to have a different way of viewing the world, having a different way of viewing the body, having a different way of viewing physiology. We can begin to see into this other thing. But at a certain point, all that stuff that we learned and all those great things our teachers told us, maybe not all of them, but many of them, scaffolding that gets taken down at a certain point.
Yeah.
You know, and we're left with our experience, and we're left with our inquiry, and we're left with our not knowing.
And that's where you have, you're gradually replacing maybe that institutionalized knowledge with another scaffolding, which is your clinical experience.
Exactly. Which, of course, changes over the years as well.
Yeah. And I don't have that. And that's where I, you know, bring in all the commentaries from the histories. But on the other hand, I have learned that my understanding of farming, of irrigation, of, and you're laughing. You're laughing. But I'm not kidding. I think that my experience flood irrigating an orchard over many years and managing waterways, I mean, that's perfect for understanding chi flow. It's exactly the same. They use the same language. Brooks and streams and springs and blockages, congestions, draining, overflowing, spilling. It's the same language.
Yeah. Microcosm, macrocosm. There you are.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
I want to jump into a couple things from the book if we can.
Sure.
Okay. So I've got just enough Chinese to be dangerous.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no.
No, no. I mean, we're not going to be speaking Chinese, but there are some things that I read them and they just, man, it was like, I don't know. I can remember when I first started studying Chinese. And I had this incredible epiphany one day. I'm not kidding you. You're going to think this is hilarious. But the truth is, I had this incredible epiphany one day when I took this piece of Chinese that I was given in school, and I realized that I had it right side up. Right?
What was it?
I don't remember. It's just, you know, some basic terminology, right? But I'm
Or a sentence.
No. It was like a sheet of paper with a bunch of characters on it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I just remember at one point going, oh, this is right side up.
Yay! You learned something.
It's silly, but I can remember this incredible delight that ran through my entire body when I recognized I have the paper the right side up. It's a good place to start. So I was reading.
I know. I love taking the students to the garden. There's a wonderful Chinese garden in Portland.
Oh, yeah. It's great. Yeah.
And I love taking the students there, and they would recognize characters.
It's fun, isn't it?
It's so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so you've got this lovely little riff on change, Bianhua.
Oh, dear. Yes.
And you talk about, I mean, Bianhua means change. But then you go into each one, you go into Bian as being a certain kind of change, and Hua as being like the transformative, you know, rug pulled out from under your feet, transformative kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
For the listener's benefit, can you talk to us a little bit about what a Bian type change looks like and what a Hua type change looks like? And maybe there's some suggestions from the book about how you deal with each of those particular kinds of processes.
Yeah, that's a deep question. I should have never agreed to this interview.
Too late now.
and really, you know, I struggled with translating these two characters forever and ever and ever. Because I used to have, I think, Bian as transformation and Hua is change. And it was just like, I just picked, I don't know if Wiseman picked them or Unschuld or somehow I just, and I always was kind of like, I know they're different. They're used in different contexts. I know, you know, it's like, it's so often that it's like Jing and Mai for channel and vessel. We have these characters that they're different characters. And in English, they're translated with words that are kind of have the same meaning, but there is a real difference between using jing and mai. There are associations, you know, whether it's the flesh radical, the jing versus the water radical, and you can go into all these examples where two characters mean the or they're translated in English with one word, but they're really two different concepts. And if you translate them with one word in English, at some point the reader gets confused because they're like, wait, this doesn't make sense, because there's contradictions. Where in Chinese there is a layer of specificity that it's really hard to express in English. And change is one of those concepts where the classical Chinese were really hung up on change, because everything is qi, and qi is always changing. And this appreciation for change, if you understand change, that's the key to being a doctor, a sage, a farmer, a ruler. Knowing change is knowing
a stockbroker, for that matter.
Exactly. Anything. Everything. Mm-hmm. A sourdough baker. Mm-hmm. You have to know. I love to bake. A cheesemaker. I love to make fermenting things. You have to be able to look at your sourdough and read where the bubbles are at and know what the temperature of the room was when you started it, what kind of grain you used. If you use rye versus wheat versus white flour versus coarse meal versus ground flour, blah, blah, blah. It all, you might get the bubbles might look the same, but depending on all these other things, it completely changes how you're going to treat that sourdough, when you're going to, how much you're going to need it, how much liquid, how much other stuff you're going to add to it, when you're going to put it in the pan, how warm you're going to bake it. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense, which is why I'm so interested in the difference between bien and hua at this point. I mean, it's really got me thinking, wow, we're always looking at change. I mean, I Ching, right? Book of Changes. We know nothing stays the same. But, you know, the question is, it's like, what's the pace or the tempo or the quality or the type? Because this is just my sense. If we've got a sense of what kind of change we're looking at, we can tune our treatment to match what that is. Okay.
And that's what it's all about, that as a clinical practitioner or a ruler or whatever it is that you're doing, you're looking at the present. You're looking at what you got. You've got, you're taking a history. You're looking at the past. And what makes a good doctor or a good ruler or a good farmer is to know the direction where the arrow is going, with the dynamic that the force, you know whether it's going up. You've got your present place, but it's really, if you know where it's coming from, you know whether it's going up or it's going down, and you also know how fast it's going, and then you know how you're going to interfere if you need to do anything. Maybe the body is on its way already to establishing this dynamic equilibrium, and if you're going to introduce a really strong down draining formula, you're going to weaken a body in a way that's going to turn it into the other extreme. So, I think that's the trick to being a good doctor or good anything is understanding change and knowing how to read the present. And that's what the Tao is. That's the core of the Tao, is it's all change. So I ended up, let's see, and I actually took notes because I knew you were going to ask me this. And it's like they're bien and hua. But what I ended up for the book, I believe, is alteration for bien and hua for transformation. Mm-hmm. And transformation is a little bit of a, not the perfect translation, maybe. It is if you're a nerd and if you read my commentary. Because literally, transformation means you are transcending the form. Another way you could put it is metamorphosis. It's hua is a sudden change that is irreversible. And bien, this is just in general, if you're trying to tease apart the difference between these two characters, of course, knowing that in modern Chinese, bianhua just means change. And to a certain extent, they can be sometimes used interchangeably, depending on if you have a poem where one of them sounds better than the other, or you have a sloppy writer, or, you know, just like in English, sometimes words are used very specifically. And my belief is in medical technical literature, a lot of times this language was very, very specialized, and it was used. Classical Chinese is so condensed that people used words very, very carefully. And we owe it to them in translation to not be sloppy and not to say, it's chabudo, you know, it's like, it's whatever. It's close.
It's in the ballpark. Yeah. Chabudo.
My experience is that they are very conscious. And when they use a word like hua, they had the association, which any person who has a PhD in Chinese studies or any traditional scholar physician will know Zhuangzi talking about hua. And when you open a big classical Chinese dictionary, the first definition you get about hua is the way it is used in Zhuangzi. And Zhuangzi was so important because Zhuangzi is kind of the gold standard for beautiful literature. So Zhuangzi talks about the transformation from the big fish to the bird, which is a total change. It's a transformation. There's something that happens that is irreversible. And a lot of times in the Neijing, hua is used in a sense where something is created. So it is creative. It's a kind of change that creates something new. And bian is used in the sense of day and night altering, low and high tides, the changes of the seasons, gradual change.
In recent years, the Sa'am acupuncture style has generated significant interest and a loyal and growing following. In the Sa'am approach, a precise diagnosis leads to a four-needle treatment to address the five element and six qi imbalances in the body. The four needles target the controlling and generating cycles. It's common using this method for the needle sensation to be stronger than in many other styles. Thus, the choice of needle becomes important. The Unico brand of needles lends itself to both strong and gentle techniques. These superior needles are made of uncoated Japanese surgical stainless steel and feature the best guide tube on the market with its unique beveled edge. Additionally, Unico needles have a tensile property that helps with freehanding needles into Jingwell points and allows you to more easily feel the arrival of qi. Blue Poppy is the exclusive importer and distributor of Unico needles. Use the code QI2024 to save 10% off Unico needles at www.bluepoppy.com. You'll be glad you did. The more comfortable kind of change, maybe the kind of change, oh yeah, this again, I feel like I'm getting nowhere kind of change, but you're like incrementally drip by drip getting somewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas often people come in, you know, with some horrible thing that happened and it's a hua type change.
This is where you come in with your clinical experience. Mm-hmm. And this is why I love having these conversations with practitioners, with clinical practitioners, because you can take what I just told you, and I love team teaching that this way, where you take what I just said and you come up with an example from clinic. So give me an example for where it's a real clinical difference.
Okay, so that's a great question. Yeah, oh man. Wait, the tables just got turned on me.
Exactly.
Yes, very good. Very sneaky, Ms. Wilms. Okay, so let's take fertility for a moment. Fertility is often a situation where someone's actually looking for a hua. They're actually looking for a hua. They want to transform from not pregnant to pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. That's a type of a metamorphosis.
Yes.
But they're making this slow incremental change, right? I mean, maybe their periods are really a mess and you got to get that cleaned up. And maybe, you know, there's issues like, well, actually,
when the woman's fertile, I mean, the guy's traveling all the time. They don't even have a chance to have sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
So small, incremental bien type changes, like, well, maybe the husband gets a different job so they can actually be together enough to create a family.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And of course, people go to IVF looking for a Hua type treatment. Right. So there's situations where people are wanting it. There's something they don't have. They desire to have it, and they're looking to get it in a Hua type way. They call that success, and we call ourselves good practitioners when we give it to them. Then there's the opposite. There's a person that's gone through a Hua type experience, and whatever they've gotten out, whatever they have transformed into, whatever they have metamorphosized into, irreversibly turned into, they'd like to get rid of it. And so I have found in my clinical practice, it's helpful to know, number one,
mm-hmm.
what kind of change are they looking for? Are they looking for a Bien type change or a Hua type change? Secondly, what kind of change are they actually in the midst of? Because it tells me something about their psychoemotive state. So I've started taking, this is from reading your book, I started taking these two and bringing them into the clinic in a way where I leave myself open to, I bring it in as a question, really. Is this a Bien process or a Hua process that they're in? And what's called for to help them with that? Does that answer your question? Does that help?
It does. It does. I mean, the your readers are the ones that... I think so. And I think the example of pregnancy is the perfect example for it is a and every process of change in a way is a combination of Bien and Hua.
Absolutely.
And that's where, and this is kind of what I love about this book is you talk about yin and yang, and then there's yang within yin, and then there's the yin within the yang. I mean, there's you can talk about it at a really simple level where Hua is a creative change. So giving birth or getting pregnant, that's conception. That's a Hua. That's a creative, irreversible change. But at the same time, you're right. You can also see it in terms of all the little incremental Bien changes that are taking place throughout this whole process. And what is the appropriate role of you in interfering, supporting, manipulating that process?
I love the way you use the word interfering. I don't often hear practitioners talk about interfering. I hear them talk about treatment. I hear them talking about helping their patients. I love that you use the word interfere. I think, and why do I enjoy that? Because it really makes me ponder for a moment about what is it that I'm going to be doing with this person? Because if I'm interfering, I want to make sure I'm interfering in some sort of beneficial way, hopefully with as light a touch as possible.
And I think my thinking on that has evolved based on studying Sun Simiao so much.
Mm. Tell us more about that.
That Sun Simiao talks about this in, and of course, I've had my head in gynecology and pediatrics, but also in his volume on dietetics, he talks about how food is just another kind of medicine. It's drugs. And if you take any substance, even a cup of tea, and introduce it to your body unaware, everything is qi. So everything that you introduce into your body changes the dynamic of qi, the equilibrium. It's a dynamic equilibrium. And it's not a static, perfect balance. It's this, and I love that fluidity, and that's change. And it's always, sometimes there's more yang and sometimes there's more yin, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And sometimes it's appropriate to interfere. And maybe sometimes it's not, because it's just that pendulum going back and forth. So he talks in the volume on dietetics, he talks about how drugs are like soldiers. And sometimes we need to release the soldiers to the borders to protect the country. But a lot of times there is a risk when you release soldiers that they then, you let them loose and then they turn around and they run out of control and they might do more damage in your own country, or they might do more damage than, or they might do unanticipated damage after they have protected your defenses from the outside. So, you know, you don't want to give somebody some really intense treatment if you can just tell them to warm their feet at night. Or you know, the idea is you want to create this equilibrium. And to me, that's what I love about the classics, that there is this, it's not just about treating illness. And of course, I have a privileged perspective because I don't treat sick people. So you deal with situations. People don't come to you generally, I assume. They come to you when their equilibrium is pretty much out of whack. So
Yes, that I would say that's true.
Yeah. So you need to, and they have certain expectations.
Of course they do.
To do something to make them feel better. Whereas I have my head in the classics and it's all about Zhi Wei Bing. You treat what is not yet diseased. You dig the well before you're thirsty, and you are dealing with a situation where you're in the middle of a war, and then, and this is a quote from that Su Wen 5 too, you don't forge your weapons while you're in the middle of the war, and you don't dig your well when you're thirsty.
So what that says to me is, even when someone comes in and for them it's some kind of an emergency, or they wouldn't be coming in to see me.
Yeah.
It's still really important not to forget that there's an equilibrium that can be found, and to attend to the dynamic, right? Attend to the dynamic. Because if the equilibrium can come of its own accord, or if it can be enticed in a more gentle fashion, well, I mean, there's a line too. You know, what is that line? I think it's from the Tao Te Ching, right? That, you know, the best rulers are the ones where the people say, we did it ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. All right. I've got so much more I want to ask you, so I'm probably just going to invite you back for another time, but you're in trouble now.
You're going to have to start sending me tea.
You know, I was just thinking I could send you some tea. I got some great stuff from Taiwan recently. I'll send you some. You'll love it.
Oh, I'm totally bribable with tea.
Okay, good.
All right. you said you were going to be up here, so we can do this in person. We can have a hot toddy by the beach.
We'll have a hot toddy by the beach, and I'll bring you some tea as well. Anyway, one more question before we get off here.
And we can have the whales part of it.
I'm all for it.
It won't be humming with elephants. It'll be the spouting of the whales.
With whales.
I saw one like a week ago.
Lovely. All right. I want to get back to your book again for just a second. I love the way that you work with the language. You're so thoughtful with it. You know, again, I know enough Chinese to be a danger to myself. And so sometimes I look at the words that you work with, or the some of the ideas that you are nonging, right? You're like manipulating. And I just find it enticing. So I want to ask you.
And it's based on 5 years of rewriting and rewriting and rewriting.
Oh, yeah. Well, and all the years that came before that, too. So let's not forget that.
It's. I love this chapter, and I have so much respect. And I really had a hard time publishing this book. It was very stressful because I just feel like it is so deep, and it requires that kind of respect from anybody.
So you should drink it with a hot toddy, or read it with a hot toddy. Anyway, I want to get back to this question. So you were talking about the elements, and you were talking about two, right? Like, usually gets translated as earth. But in your book, you say that you rather enjoy thinking of two, not as earth, but as soil, right? And when I think of soil, I think of something that's like something simultaneously in the process of rotting and generating new life at the very same moment. I'm curious. I would just like to hear you riff a little bit more about, what if instead of calling two earth, we did call it soil? What if we thought of it as soil?
I would have loved to do that. And it's kind of a perfect example for my struggles with terminology in this book. I don't want to have the book use foreign language. It was really important to me that this book is readable to your average classically inclined Chinese medicine practitioner. Mm. And that's, I can't say five elements, even though that's the standard term.
I know, it's so totally wrong.
I think I did dynamic agents. Five phases works better. The elements, that's one where I'm on this mission where I cannot get myself to say elements, even though I know that's what everybody uses. With earth, the problem with earth is that in English, earth has so many different meanings, you know, as in the planet earth. Soil is much more specific, and the meaning of that dynamic agent, it should be soil. So I love the fact that you picked up on that, and that's exactly the association that you should have. It's dirt. It's black, rich, fertile. It's the stuff where, you know, a little bright green sprout comes out of, and it's alive with earthworms, and it's what feeds everything. It's the spleen and earth. The spleen stomach. But I decided to stick with earth because that's just the way we know the five elements, and I felt like if I changed it to soil, it would force people who are just in their training. They're just so, everybody's used to using earth as the earth element, you know? So I just didn't want to be too radical.
Yeah. So you just stayed with the standard on that. But I got to tell you, when I read that and you called it soil, the first thought that came to my mind was dirt. And I just laughed out loud. I was like, oh man, that's great. It's so humble. It's like, you know, it's
it is. Earth, yes.
Earth element. It's like, yeah, no, it's dirt.
Exactly. And it's everywhere. And it is what grows our food. It's, you know, yeah, exactly. That's really important.
Okay. Well, maybe people listening to this podcast will start calling the earth phase dirt or soil. I don't know. We might have started something here or not. At any rate, I so appreciate you taking the time today and sitting down for me with a cup of tea and talking about this stuff that's in your book. Again, I'm going to plug it. I can't help myself. It's an exquisite read. It sits on my poetry shelf, actually, not my Chinese medicine shelf, just so you know. It's gorgeous. It will mess with your mind in really delicious ways. So I encourage you guys to go buy a copy.
Thank you. Hmm. I love getting feedback. And it was not an easy book. It's a lot more personal than my other books, which were mostly just translations. And I didn't know if it was going to be, you know, useful. I don't know how, because I'm in my world. I'm in my crazy bubble of classics. So it makes me really happy.
All right. Well, thank you. And all right. So we'll do part two when I come out to Seattle.
Deal.
Okay.
It was delightful. Thank you.
Thanks as always for listening. If you liked this conversation, if you learned something new or found a moment of inspired insight, share the episode with your friends. If you want to support Geological, there's just one way to do that. It's by going to the website and becoming a member or leaving a one-time contribution today. Well, folks, that's it for today. Join us again next Tuesday for another conversation that connects up the voices of our community.